Paper 13. Section 2, finally. Made it through that great big long section. So we're at the bottom of old single column, page 147. Okay, so now you'll see that for most of the rest of the paper, they try to break free from their bondage to statements like, well, there's not really anything that you could possibly understand about that. And, you know, like we were talking about last time, you know, in dealing with the sacred spheres of paradise, it's all very, very transcendent in many ways. But you'll see as we get into the ensuing sections here that they use the opportunity to try to really invoke some reflection on our parts about how some of these higher facts do indeed have immediate relevancy to our lives, if you have the courage to face the facts of the statements they bring forward and not just deflect them all as talking about someone else.
I know somebody who did
it. Yeah. This first section, you can see, is immediately tied into the details of going through all seven worlds of the Father, like we just did, and bringing out a few additional facts with, like I said, that desire to increase the relevancy for us. So let's roll into it here.
Section 2, Father's World Relationships. These home worlds of the diverse orders of spiritual beings are tremendous and stupendous spheres, and they are equal to paradise in their matchless beauty and superb glory. There are rendezvous worlds, reunion spheres, serving as permanent cosmic addresses. As finaliters, you will be domiciled on paradise, but Ascendington will be your home address at all times, even when you enter service in outer space. Through all eternity, you will regard Ascendington as your home of sentimental memories and reminiscent recollections. When you become seventh stage spirit beings, possibly you will give up your residential status on paradise. If outer universes are in the making, if they are to be inhabited by time creatures of ascension potential, then we infer that these children of the future will also be destined to look upon Ascendington as their paradise home world.
All right, a couple things. One right at the beginning there, it's another just a simple little passing example of them never missing an opportunity to see if you notice an and. You know, joining two things. So yeah, tremendous and stupendous. You know, it's like, you know, it should get you to pause. Like, well, why? Why two things? I mean, wouldn't one have been adequate?
Tremendous would have been pretty good.
Yeah. Think about where those two words come from, what the roots are of those two words. Okay, tremendous, the root there is tremble. So in other words, you're so struck from a spiritual consciousness point of view that you tremble. Okay. And stupendous, in other words, you're so struck from a material consciousness point of view as to be stupefied. To stand there just stunned, you know, and not able to really process any sort of understanding, Okay? It's spiritual consciousness and material consciousness. Two different ways of thinking about how, from our current perspective, you know, where those are real separate and prone to trembling, for instance, you know, we all know that there's a long tradition of you get too worked up spiritually, you start shaking. Okay, see. See, so that's why. They're trying to see if they can get you to notice that and figure out that one is spiritual consciousness and one is material consciousness. Just another little opportunity to recognize the two on equal footing and attempt to put them together into cosmic consciousness. They just never miss, you know, an opportunity. Now, on a little bit more technical point about the Father's worlds. This whole issue that they're mentioning there, you know, I'm really giving you, like I said, one of the things they're doing is they'll be precise in clarifying things. You know, what's the difference between your relationship to paradise and your relationship to Ascendington? You know, like they're doing there in terms of residential, you know, or, well, which is your hometown. You know, Ascendington's your hometown, even though your residence is on, your standing residence is on paradise. But, you know, that whole issue of, you know, why exactly Ascendington? Why not Divinington? I mean, you know, didn't the revelation get me all worked up from the moment I started reading it about the notion of an adjuster, that I have this fragment of the Father within me? He told me point blank that Divinington is the home of that Father fragment. Shouldn't that be my hometown? It's like, well, maybe it's just a temporary thing. Maybe it's just, you know, when I'm really kind of still in the mode where I've ascended and I'm sort of still working off what I acquired ascending, maybe that's why it's Ascendington. No, what do they say? Through all eternity, you will regard Ascendington as your hometown. So what does that imply? It's a point that I've been trying to work in as the context allowed a number of times over the recent times. You don't have, and you never will have, even in eternity, you never will have a relationship directly with that existential virgin adjuster. Never. You're an experiential creature. You're never going to have even a little bit of direct relationship to that existential fact. What do you have a relationship to? That adjuster comes out. It begins to acquire experience. It begins to wrap an experiential nature around that existential core. It begins to wrap a mother-coordinated nature around that father-initiated core. You only and forever will have a relationship to that experiential acquirement. That's what you relate to. As you dwell in the experiential domain, you dwell in the whole. Not that you don't dwell on the transcendental absolute points outside of the whole that anchor the whole from without. You dwell within. And this distinction is vital. For in a cosmic system, the individual members are not connected with each other except in relation to the whole and through the individuality of the whole. Okay? There's an existential fact, and there's yourself. They're not related to each other except through the mother, through the individuality of the whole. And that's what that experiential acquirement that surrounds that father core, that adjuster, that's what that is. That's a literalization of that connection of it to you through the individuality of the whole. That relationship has been made a literal fact that you can grip and soak in it as an existential fact. But you never do the two of you touch directly, because it's like this. It's the easiest way to understand why you don't. The existential fact is up here. And you know, it's transcendent of where you ever will be, no matter how high you climb. It's on the outside. Okay? But there's a bridging, you know, and that part of the mystery of mysteries is, even almost, you know, immediately, it can take something from that completely transcendent state and bring it down and to touch you, bridge that incredible gap. I mean, part of the way to understand that mystery is the fact of the mother. The mother isn't just at some level, and it isn't just some point. You know, it pervades a given level, and you know, and is hierarchically spread throughout the whole vertical structure. So there isn't anything that's too high for it to be bridged through the individuality of the whole mother. You know, the hierarchy of the mother starts all the way at the highest high point and goes all the way down to us, you know, and meets us where and as we are. That's the key. And see, just, you know, if you just notice that, a little detail like that, it really is trying to challenge us to not have some magical, fanciful notion about this gesture, that we're just going to touch the Father and magically be done. You know, what you're going to do is you're going to begin to work your way up, you know, and through the mother and ever, ever and higher deity of the mother, have a relationship to that transcendent fact.
Can you give us a synonym for individuality? I get all hung up on that word, through the individuality of the whole.
Well, the key is there is, you don't just have a spirit fact. So that it's just this perfectly equal unity. I mean, a number of ways that you could begin to kind of think about what you have, starting with that sort of a picture. You know there's some sort of a ubiquitous presence, say, to the Creative Mother Spirit. But she's thicker at the center, you could say. Or, you know, maybe you want to look at it sort of vertically and three-dimensionally. You know, it reaches down in a center point, you know, sort of extended down, you know, from a an elastic sheet, you know, up above. It draws down to engage you. There is a centeredness to it, not just a sourceness to it. There's an individuality. That's what you mean by that word, individuality. If something doesn't have some measure of individuation, of individuality, the personality gift from the Father has nothing to identify with. If you didn't have your individuality consciousness, if you just had your spirit consciousness, if you just think of the personality, you know, one way to understand personality is talking about it as spirit pattern, you think, well, I'd have all I need because I've got this relationship to spirit and the personality is going to grab that. No. Because, you know, thinking right now about personality as spirit pattern is in the same sense of calling your adjuster a pure spirit fragment. It's the initial point of finite understanding, but the adjuster is also pure energy and everything in between, you might say, because it's a fragment of the Father. It's a fragment of a fact that's pre-separation between individuality and unity. Okay? And so is the personality. And so, you know, it's initially kind of just, it's sort of a finite illusion, you might say, that personality is just spirit pattern. It actually is intimately associated with the individuality of you. I mean, it's in your individuality is indispensable to its identification. You know, because you have individuality consciousness that's engaged by personality, you can say, I am. If you didn't have that individuality consciousness, you wouldn't have that thought in your head. You could never speak the words that prove the Father has touched you, because that gift from the Father needs your individuality consciousness.
Does it have something to do with indivisibility?
It has to do with differentiation out of some sort of a background. That there's, in some way, there's a localized aspect to it. You know, like I was saying with the, with the creative mother spirit. I mean, in a really big picture, you could say, well, she's only present in the local universe, and there's an individuation there. But immersed in it, okay, you know, you can't understand that perspective. So how could I understand that there's an individuality to that whole presence? You know, there's a seat, an anchor point, a center on Salvington. There's a localization, a relative individuation. It's an individuality. Okay? And hence, it can be personalized. If something doesn't have some measure of individuation like that, it can't be personalized. Okay? And that's why a solitary messenger is such a fascinating individual, you know, to the revelators. Because it is, in many ways, it's hard for people to even recognize its individuation, and yet it's definitively a personality. So it seems to be right on the borderline, as sort of this minimal individuation in order to be personalized. So that's, your spiritual consciousness has difficulty with differentiation, discrimination, individuation, individuality, all those sorts of words. And so the spiritual consciousness needs to be challenged on that. It needs to be taught that individuality is indispensable. If you lose your individuated selfness, your measure of separation, distinction from the background, you can forget about the Father. The Father can't touch you anymore. You know, that's the thing. If you begin to let go of the localization of yourself, if you do things that tend to diffuse you into the source that fills all space, you're going to lose your personality. It's a dangerous thing to do. The Father can't grip something if it gets too diffuse. It has to be localized. It has to be individuated.
And you know, that brings to mind women, for instance. They, in the past, have lost their individuality because they've had the olden days. The man was the head of everything, and the woman was just like nothing. So she was just this person that was enveloped in the source of the mother, but she had no individuality.
Yeah, now think about, you know, as a female, you're a downstepped expression, you know, very directly here in our local universe, of our local universe, creative mother spirit. What is the nature of that fact? That fact is not a source center. You know, like first source and center. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not a source hyphen center. The foundation is not center with source added to it. You're a downstepped expression of the reciprocal. Center source. Okay? And just like with the creative mother spirit, where she doesn't start out as a creative mother spirit, she doesn't start out as a center source. She starts out as just a creative spirit, as just a source. And then subsequently adds centeredness, you know, begins to have this condensation on Salvington where her sort of foot is planted. Okay. A woman goes through the same temporal process. Initially, perforce, she must be more source than center, so she can be mother to the children. You don't want to have this Achilles heel in immature humans of too much initial centeredness, because then the mother will get too focused on self and abandon the children, and the children will die. So the woman is designed to be a downstep expression of the creative mother spirit. First source, then you go through menopause, okay, and you begin to leave that behind of being, you know, needing to be just, you know, mostly that's a source fact. Remember, it's fonta, the first source is what that literally means, okay? Source, not center, source, okay? And then you can begin to coalesce into a more point-like, center-like individuation. So you have a vulnerability by design in the early phase of your life, where if the civilization is not very high, if men have a limited consciousness, you have an Achilles heel. You're not very center-like. And men, you know, immature men have always known that and have abused that fact. A true man, you know, cherishes that fact, you know, and guards that fact until you can begin to take on some, you know, individual integrity yourself and can stand a little bit more on your own. That's the way it's supposed to work. The two are complementary. Yeah. So that's a great example of how the revelation can completely transform an endless, go-nowhere conversation amongst mankind. An argument in a vacuum. I mean, you'll never understand what's going on if you don't understand what you are and why you're that way. And to notice that it's not like you were created in an environment that is incomplete. It's like, well, how dare someone make me have an Achilles heel? Well, you're not supposed to be an island universe. You're supposed to be part of a cosmic system. You're supposed to be dependent upon complementary individuals in order to be complete. And especially when you're starting out at a very lowly level of reality, these incompletenesses are going to be quite extreme sometimes. Could be very large unpainted spots on the back of your foot. Okay, if you remember the old Achilles heel story, okay? I mean, you could have, you know, a weak spot that you can drive a semi-truck through, okay? And so, you know, we need to all understand what our limitations are by design, at least to begin with here, how we're supposed to work together. We need to challenge each other to create a civilization that is predicated on that recognition and does what it needs to do. Okay, we can't turn women into men, or it's the last generation of mankind, because children will die if there's nothing but men. There needs to be women, and there needs to be men. And we can't, you know, be constantly looking longingly at each other. Oh, if only I was you, you know. If only, you know, I mean, it's not just women doing that to men. Men do it, like, wow, you know. Wish I didn't have to, you know, go to work at the coal mine. You know, I'm probably going to get blown up today. But ours is not to question why. Ours is but to do and die. I mean, sure would be nice if I had that sense about me and I could stay home and tend the hearth. You know, because kind of rose-colored glasses, if you actually go and tend the hearth, you know, it's not just a warm little hearth. There's screaming kids running around, you know, smearing goo all over everything. And, you know, and it's a little bit more complicated than it appears from this idyllic outside vantage point. Okay, but, you know, see, we need to stop setting ourselves against each other like this. We're not supposed to be island universes. We're supposed to be complementary. You know, women are supposed to definitively need men, and men are supposed to definitively need women.
Yeah. But the point I was trying to make was that a lot of them lose their identity.
Sure, right. See, and just understand, see why. It's you know, and so you want to make sure that when you have a daughter and you're teaching that daughter as her parents, you want to foster the beginnings of the integrity choice. And a woman needs to really actively choose, because if she doesn't choose, she's fuzzed out, kind of just by design. You need to encourage that girl to have some initial integrity, not so much that she severs herself from being part of the cosmic system, but enough where, for instance, you know, she has enough individual integrity that she can look at two guys and discriminate between them. Okay, so this is the kind of thing this is the kind of schools, education, that the revelation needs to foster. Schools where you talk about things that aren't politically correct. Schools that talk about things that seem to be in complete defiance to all of human history, thinking, yeah, that's the whole point. The actual revelation here is in direct contradiction with all of the preconceived opinions, settled ideas, and longstanding prejudices. All of them. It's an epical revelation. It comes right at your most cherished, long-held, never-questioned assumptions and tries to take them down. That's the point of an epical revelation. And you have to be courageous to take on an epical revelation. You have to be not only courageous, but you probably need to be in some way dissatisfied with those long-standing things. You know, if that worldview still totally gets it done for you, if you can rationalize everything that goes on in your life with that old worldview, you're not looking for revelation. And if you try to engage this, you're going to find it not satisfying if you read it with any definitiveness, because it's going to just be flying in the face of your cherished beliefs. It's trying to challenge all of our cherished beliefs. Everything that we thought about God, everything that we thought about the opposite sex, everything that we thought about history, everything that we thought about science, everything has to be... Behold, not some things are going to be, all things. You have to go through every single thing. Art, your whole notion of art, everything has to be completely remade. Your whole notion of humor, your whole notion of politics, your whole notion of economics. Everything has to be completely remade.
The mores of today, the progressive mores, the people that are, you know, supposedly on the cutting edge, is that... you know, if you discriminate, if you show any discrimination, that you're not, you know, that's almost evil.
think about what the revelation tries to teach us about that. Like you said, I mean, right now we have sort of the running assumption that to discriminate is evil. What does the revelation teach us about this? It teaches us that the only way that evil can actualize is because of a failure to truly discriminate. That's what leads to evil. Evil is a failure of discrimination. You have failed to discriminate between good and bad. With the best of intentions, you've grabbed a hold of bad because you didn't discriminate. You don't have the eyes to distinguish. You don't have the individuality consciousness to discriminate good from bad. Your unity consciousness has blurred the two together. You know, you've defocused You know, when you defocus, everything in this room all blurs together into one smudge. Men and women are the same smudge. You know, everything good and bad is the same smudge.
Individuals and groups.
Right. Individuals and groups are the same. You lose all ability to discriminate, which means even in a purely randomized setting, 50% of the time, you're going to do evil. You know, with the desire to do good. You're going to be evil 50% of the time if it's perfectly randomized. But of course, it actually works just the opposite. You know, you end up, favoring evil in your desire to be good if you don't have the discrimination, because the evil plays into sophistries that you're prone to. So you actually end up doing pretty much the opposite of what you desired. You know, you wanted to be 90% good, and you end up being 90% bad. Because of your lack of discrimination.
Discernment is a great word.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, discernment, yeah. Discrimination, differentiation, you know, all those words.
Can you go into more of the definition of what you mean by discrimination?
That's a great exercise for you guys. To look up those words, look up differentiate, discriminate, discern. You know, look up, notice the subtle differences between them so that you can understand, for instance, you know, why, oops, I'm going the wrong way. When you get to paper 16, section 6, and it's talking about the second cosmic intuition, it says this is the judicial form of cosmic discrimination. Why did they use discrimination for the moral one? Why didn't they use discernment? Why didn't they use differentiation? They very purposely choose discrimination. Figure out why.
That's what morals are about.
Okay. This is the mathematical form of cosmic discrimination. They even used it for the first cosmic intuition. Okay. This is the highest insight of the cosmic mind, the reverential and worshipful form of cosmic discrimination. The spiritual insight is a discrimination even. It's a threefold discrimination. The very fact that that word is treated as negative is what you were just trying to point out. See? I mean, we are so twisted around that we think that which is actually positive is negative. We think that discrimination is bad. It's actually good. So in your effort to not discriminate, you pick the opposite of that which discriminates. So in your effort to pick good, you pick bad. See, because discrimination is good. And if your brain is kind of hurting right now, yeah, that just shows you how all things need to become new here. You got to go all the way back and start over again. You've got to let go of what culture has said to you about the word discrimination. You've got to rediscover the true meaning of the word discrimination and its incredible, indispensable nature in the entire cosmos. How what you're striving for, and along some lines, is absolute discrimination. You get to Havona, and there's an economy. There are the laws of the house of Havona. Okay, Nomi, laws, eco, house. Okay, there's an economy to Havona. You have to perfectly discriminate between a million different things and the one and only one right way to do something. You have to get into an absolute discrimination mode where you're gonna reject an infinite number of possibilities and choose the one that is anchored in the infinite one. You know, there is one right way. Because it's the best way. Can you discriminate between poor and best? Do you want to discriminate between poor and best? These are the sorts of things. This is what the fifth epical revelation is about. Trying to bring in individuality consciousness into an increasingly confused, spiritually uplifted people. 2,000 years ago, the confusion began because we began to be spiritual enough to be truly confused. Okay, if you don't have much unity consciousness, because it hasn't been uplifted by Michael, I mean, you're a material being. You're pretty much just individuality, an egotistic, you know, selfish little kid by nature. So it's hard to get too confused and blur things together. You know, you have a tendency to go the other direction and, yeah, be hyper discriminating.
How does tolerance figure into all of this?
Yeah, tolerance. The cosmic definition of tolerance is tempered zeal. A very tricky thing. Tempered zeal. How do I put reins on my zeal? It doesn't say, it's not the opposite of zeal, like you might think, tolerance is.
I was trying to relate it to discrimination.
Right. So, right, but that's your, it way it fits into the discrimination is you're given zeal for a reason. You're given zeal to have zeal for ideals. If you can't discriminate between ideas and ideals, you can't properly direct your zeal towards ideals. You're going to be random, and there's more ideas out there than there are ideals. So, most of the time you're going to direct it at an idea instead of an ideal if you have no discrimination between the two. And so tolerance, tempered zeal, you're going to hold back your zeal being applied to an idea like you, in distinction from me. Steve is a very different idea than Chris. I'm going to be tolerant of you because I'm not going to, use my zeal directed towards you and turn this differential into a quasi-religious quandary, where I guess I got to choose. It's either Chrisism, or anti-Steveism. Notice I didn't even, think about Steveism. That's, you're going to temper that. You're going to neutralize some of that. You're only going to let zeal loose on ideals. I'll let my zeal loose on the ideals that might float above you and about you. But the ideas, the stuff that's been brought down and is individuated, I'm just going to let that be. That's what Jesus tried to teach us,
Right, but I also think of discrimination of treating certain people unfairly.
Right, and so now, see, can you see what has happened to the word discrimination? I just pointed out that it was used in all three cosmic intuition paragraphs. That it was the punchline, the punch word, bottom line of all three of those. It's supposed to be objective. If you turn discrimination into a subjective phenomenon, then you get what everyone thinks of. When they, you get this subjective thing where, as near as you can tell, you're innately divine, the universe revolves around you, and everything else is other. And you look down your nose at everything. You get that subjective quote unquote discrimination. See, which isn't truly discrimination. That's a corruption of discrimination. Just like taking your moral consciousness, an objective fact, and debasing it into some subjective thing that you call morality or moralism. See, you've turned it into a subjective thing. You've corrupted it. And we need to discriminate between the subjective and the objective, and we need to know which words are meant only for the objective so that we can use them.
Discrimination is the wrong way to be discriminated.
Right. See, there, we need to get rid of that thought. We need to stop using that word for a subjective thing, right, because it's forcing us to want to eliminate the word from the language,
right,
which means we're purposely pulling back from the Holy Spirit. So just everyone, you know, take a little time with a dictionary, and penetrate a little bit in the etymologies of those words and what they mean, what the spirit of those words is.
On this planet, I think what has happened is a huge breakdown of trust, because if the source center nature is meant to be trusting so that it can nurture,
mm-hmm,
then the center source nature needs to be trustworthy.
Right, and think about how much women are to blame for that. That's the challenge you should take on. It's like, wait a minute, what the heck am I doing marrying someone who's not trustworthy? Why on earth did I not discriminate?
Why are women to blame for that?
No. Don't take it too far. Notice where women could be really helping. I mean, obviously men, I mean, if you know, the fact that men are not taking on the fact that men are not taking on the, you know, the challenge to be integrous, to be trustworthy, okay, they're to blame for that. But, you know, think about how the woman is meant to be the civilizer here.
I think women have a choice.
Yeah, they do. They do. You have a
throughout history, women have had very little choice about who they marry.
It's only one in a million out there that actually is trustworthy.
Just okay, but we're not talking about the problems of primitive mind. Okay, can you not live in the past? That's what we're. Can we turn it around and go forward into the future? Can women take on the challenge? Can men take on the challenge?
Women have been viewed as a commodity, just like a bag of salt or a bag of gold, for most of.
And men have been viewed as cannon fodder.
What's that?
Ours is not the question why. Ours is about the do and die. You know, we just all line up in front of the bullets and just, you know, take them until they run out of bullets, and then the five people left, you know, conquer the other territory. Wow, that's an enlightened state of existence. I mean, neither,
nobody
is, you know, is wholly to blame. Both are equally limited. We need to take delight in cultivating. Okay? As I say, I mean, both men and women need to take delight in cultivating. Being something that is not merely the weak points of self. We need the integrity that only personality can provide, okay? And neither men nor women have taken delight in cultivating. You know, one more little thing on this. Again, use the revelation to understand your role in the picture. How much proof did Michael have to give to the creative Mother Spirit before she would marry him? He had to work his, you-know-what off for a billion years before she would say yes. Because only after a billion years of supreme effort, literally acquiring, he had to acquire supreme deity before she would say yes. He had to exert a supreme effort before she would say, okay, you are now... You've proven yourself to me to be trustworthy. She has a choice. And she did not choose to allow him in until he had proven it he was trustworthy. I mean, if he hadn't done that, she never would have said yes. Again, don't... Right. I mean, it's just like, if there wasn't a God, wouldn't the cup still fall? No. The cup only falls because God chooses to make it fall. You know, nothing is automatic. There's nothing automatic about them being eternal partners. They have absolute free will to reject each other. Okay? But they don't. But they also don't just, you know, plop out of their parents and join together in eternal bliss. They go through this whole process that mankind has never even imagined, you know, of getting to the point where both of them have demonstrated that they have the internal integrity to come together as one. Because they don't want just a relationship in name only. They want a true relationship. And in order to be a true relationship, for there to be a super additive consequence, they have to be supremely individuated and integrous. If they're two fuzzballs that overlap, you don't get any super additive consequence. You just get chaos. Okay. I think you get the point. Anyway, that and so much about of the revelation really goes to this point. You know, almost in every area, humans are too fuzzy in their thinking. We're too fuzzy in science. We're too fuzzy in economics. We're too fuzzy in all these things. We're, you know.
Fuzzy man, isn't that the?
Yeah, yeah. Right. We need to take delight in cultivating an integrity that differentiates itself out of the whole, and hence then can recognize in a true objective way the difference amongst the parts. If you haven't partized yourself, you have no part consciousness. You won't recognize, you know, you won't recognize the difference between cashews and peanuts. Okay, it'll be the same thing. You have to have an individuality consciousness, and if you don't, you literally your arms will disappear from view. You won't even be able to see anything if you lose your individuality consciousness. So I'm kind of back into the mode here. You have this, notice how they're bringing in this distinction to understand exactly, you know, what your relationship is to ascending to. In differential to your relationship to paradise. He's going to bring in some other things along that line, like, well, what about Vice Jerrington, and what about Trinity origin beings like the author, et cetera. Let's try to get some of those distinctions clarified.
Ascendington is the only sacred sphere that will be unreservedly open to your inspection as a paradise arrival. Vice Jerrington is the only sacred sphere that is wholly and unreservedly open to my scrutiny. Though its secrets are concerned in my origin, in this universe age, I do not regard Vice Jerrington as my home. Trinity origin beings and Trinitized beings are not the same. The Trinity origin beings do not fully share the Father's worlds. They have their soul homes on the Isle of Paradise in close proximity to the Most Holy Sphere. They often appear on Ascendington, the bosom of the Father, Son, Spirit, where they fraternize with their brethren who have come up from the lowly worlds of space.
Okay, so, you know, you're initially thinking, okay, so they're giving me all these details about Trinity origin beings, and okay, why do I need to know this? Yeah, notice at the end he's bringing it home, but let's get the details in play. So the first thing he points out is, now remember, you know, when I told you about Vice Jerrington, the main secrets there are about Trinitization. And yes, Trinity origin beings are Trinitized into existence, you know, rather than created or, you know, eventuated. They're Trinitized into existence. But just because you're Trinitized doesn't mean you're a Trinity origin being. Trinity origin beings are Trinitized, but Trinitized does not imply Trinity origin. Okay? A perfecter of wisdom, the author of this paper, is literally of origin solely in the Paradise Trinity. That individual produced the author of this paper. Not the Father, not the Son, not the Spirit. The Paradise Trinity individual produced this perfecter of wisdom. as a Trinity origin being, you know, it the relationship is very definitively with the upper surface of the aisle, because he's a person, and more specifically with the most holy sphere, which is that domain surrounding the three presence of the three persons, you know. That presence of the three persons is totally invested, you know, surrounded by the presence of the functioning of the Paradise Trinity, the most holy sphere. So, obviously, a Trinity origin being that is produced by the functioning of the Trinity is going to have its residence near that presence of the functioning of the Paradise Trinity. Okay, so there's that detail. And then notice what he brings in, a little bit more about you. He uses himself as a way to teach you about yourself. He says, talks about the Most Holy Spirit, and then he says that these Trinity origin beings like himself often appear on Ascendington. Why? He says it's the bosom of the Father, Son, Spirit. Think that through. From a bottom-up point of view, individuality viewpoint, you have the three persons, and the super-additive consequence of the relationship between all three is the Paradise Trinity. So that seems a pretty immediate way, if that's the bosom of the Father and the Son and the Spirit, all three, there's going to be some relationship to the Trinity. Maybe in some subtle way, but obviously all three deities' facts are in play. So so your first thought is, okay, so that must just be what he's saying. There's a measure of Trinity likeness to Ascendington, and so there he has an affinity to Ascendington as a Trinity origin being. But turn that around. Through all eternity, you regard Ascendington as your home. What is that telling you? He's using himself to tell you something about yourself. It's just what I was saying up there. You know, when you're this whole time that you're ascending and you're God the Father seeking, you're not God the Father acquiring. What are you acquiring? God the Mother likeness. You know, so, you know, especially when you're, a perfected fact as a finaliter, you're this definitive mother fact. Okay? And mother stems from the Paradise Trinity. Trinity origin beings stem from the Paradise Trinity. The two have something in common. To not just leave it with the perfecter of wisdom. That's reminding you again that you are fundamentally part of a cosmic system that has an integrity through an individuality of that whole. We are all one system, one family through the mother, not through the father, because the father initiated us. We could be part of a system, but the family itself is a direct expression of the mother. Okay, and that's what's being fraternized here. Is the common relationship to the mother. Okay? And then look at the fun little thing he did, just as a little play. He didn't say the bosom of the Father and the Son and the Spirit. He tweaked it a little bit. He put hyphens in. It's like, well, okay, when all said and done, and what's the difference? Well, yeah. But to think about it like this, okay, so you got three things hyphenated together. The third thing is the root. Starts with the Spirit, the Son is added on, and then the Father's added on. Is that not how you acquired the full mother nature when you're going through Havona? First you acquire the Spirit, then you add the Son, and then you add the Father. Circuits 5, 4, 3. Okay. So he's reminding you how you got to that state where he feels a kinship with you, how you got to your relationship with the mother. It's in that construct, Father hyphen Son hyphen Spirit. Okay. So, you see, there's actually a lot that you can unpack here. Okay, it's a lot of neat things here. All right, get a little more here.
You might assume that Creator Sons, being a father-son origin, would regard Vice Gerrington as their home, but such is not the case in this universal age of the function of God the Sevenfold. And there are many similar problems that will perplex you, for you are sure to encounter many difficulties as you attempt to understand these things which are so near paradise. Nor can you successfully reason out these questions, you know so little. And if you knew more about the Father's worlds, you would simply encounter more difficulties until you knew all about them. Mm-hmm. Status on any of these secret worlds is acquired by service, as well as by nature of origin. And the successive universe ages may and do redistribute certain of these personality groupings.
Yeah, what goes on those worlds is serious antecedent following. You know, the whole end is there from the beginning. So things can shift without, it's like, oh, we didn't plan for that. No, it's, you know, all the ability, all the adaptability potential is built in to shift with an eternity of a growing universe. Okay, now back up to the beginning, though. So Vice Gerrington was the bosom of the Father and the Son. Okay, that's technically what it is, the Father and the Son. Father and the Son on equal footing. Okay. What he said there is directly a fact. The type of deity that is personalized to make a Creator Son is this type of deity, the Father hyphen Son type deity. Father, Son are not on equal footing. The foundation is the Son with some Father added onto it. It's more definitively Son-like. It's not equally Father and Son-like. That's why Vice Gerrington is not the home. It's not equal the Father and the Son. It's the Father-Son. You know, they're not, you know, they're called Creator's sons, you know, for a reason. Because, you know, the fundamental fact is Son, with some father-likeness added onto it. Okay. So the home is going to be Sonarrington. Okay? It's not going to be one of the eternal sun's worlds, because it's not just sun. It's an agent of the sun, made agent by adding some father to it. Right? So it's Sonarrington, you know, is the hometown for Creator Sons, not Vice Gerrington. And see, he kind of sets you up to think about the hyphenated construct in the previous thing of calling it the bosom of the Father hyphen Son hyphen Spirit. He's trying to gently lead you into thinking very precisely about this so you can understand a little bit.
He's in touch with intuition of logic.
You suppose? As a perfecter of wisdom. and his comment about the in this universe age of the function of God the Sevenfold, I mean, another thing that you can see about that Father hyphen Son type deity, you know, the Creator Sons are in the Sevenfold, one of the Sevenfold Creators. Okay. And, you know, what is that vertical hierarchy? Son first, then Father added on top of that. You know, this is the whole point of the Sevenfold, is a downreaching thing. This is the foundation of it, and then this is added onto that, and this is added onto that, and, you know, et cetera. It's creature-identified deity. The foundation point is at the creature, at the being here, at the gray block at the bottom, this being engaged. See, so because he's part of that structure, that's another way of understanding why it's it's father hyphen son and not son hyphen father type deity, because the father is on top, added to the more foundational element of the son. So that's what he's alluding to with that. But see, you know, he's also saying, you know, this whole phenomenon of God the sevenfold is going to morph in the next universe age. That's a finite expression of God the sevenfold. There'll be some transcendental expression of God the sevenfold that won't look quite like that. But for this universe age, everything is coordinated to fit in. You know, he can be part of the sevenfold because he's father hyphen son instead of son hyphen father. For instance, something that technical and, you know, specific is in play. All right. Now, of course, you know, I think if I remember right, they mentioned that, you know, remember we have a relationship to Sanarrington too. So let's get to that.
The worlds of the inner circuit are really fraternal or status worlds, more than actual residential spheres. Mortals will attain some status on each of the Father's worlds save one. For example, when you mortals attain Havona, you are granted clearance for Ascendington, where you are most welcome, but you are not permitted to visit the other six sacred worlds. Subsequent to your passage through the Paradise Regime, and after your admission to the core of the finality, you are granted clearance for Sanarrington, since you are sons of God as well as ascenders, and you are even more. But there will always remain 1/7 of Sanarrington, the sector of the incarnation secrets of the divine sons, which will not be open to your scrutiny. Never will those secrets be revealed to the ascendant sons of God.
Did you notice that? Remember how, you know, when I pointed out with Sanarrington that they mentioned that the secret sector was the seventh one. Notice they sort of indirectly reminded you of that by, you know, that there's seven sectors again here. Just kind of reinforcing that. You know, they could have just said, you know, there will always remain, you know, one sector of Sanarrington, or, you know, I mean, or, you know, one portion, you know. But to, you know, 1/7, and remember which one it is. It's the seventh one. There's that. They're trying to get you to follow that clue again. You know, you'll notice that they aren't purposely doing that any other places. Again, it's very purposeful here to reiterate that seventhness there. You know, and so I mentioned that early on. So as soon as you get to Havona, you'll be able to go on vacation on Ascendington. But you can't, you know, do anything with the other ones until after you have full status. You know, and even with Ascendington, you're not, from the moment you walk into Havona, you're not going to have access to everything there. You're going to have to, you know, complete your ascension to get full access to Ascendington too, but you can, you know, land there right away.
I am curious about the method of going from place to place.
Yeah, you mean you have to be car. Right? You have to be transported by transport angels to get to go to unacquired space. They talk about that. I mean, You're beginning to develop the ability to transport yourself some. Initially, you can go backwards, but you can't go forwards without being flown. You know, and then once you finally become a finaliter, now you can transport yourself. You don't need to transport angels anymore. You know, they talk about that. I mean, it's, I think the expression they use is achieved space, I believe, is the way they word that, you know, that you can go backward on your own through achieved space. But I mean,
you can fly there?
Yeah, I mean, you can, well, you know,
there.
Yeah, I mean, the way it, you know, works is in some mysterious way we can lock onto the energy currents or whatever word you want to use, grid, flows, you know, and surf them sort of. Yeah. Okay, so Yeah, so, yeah, I mean, just maybe that one little thing that, Gene was mentioning there. You notice how often they'll use these words that really we've started to not like much because of our spiritual consciousness, words like regime. You know, the only time we like to use that word is when we say regime change. when we want to go, you know, anarchistic on regime. You know, yeah, so, yeah, I mean, there's all these words sprinkled through here that are trying to challenge you to step back and try form and order and structure anew. If you try it objectively, you'll like it. Don't judge it by its false, subjective, you know, distortion. True form is the greatest gift you could ever be given. Form that has an expression like sanity, for instance. You should like that form. Without form, you're instantly insane. The only reason you have form is because you are formed. I mean, the only reason you have sanity is because you are formed. Okay. You know, we're not self-forming. And so, the revelators are trying to get us to rediscover. It's like, I know there's been a lot of false forms and lots of false absolutes, and you've had to get into a mode where you just sort of a priori reject all form because you just know from the get-go that it's all false, and you've become so jaded. But if only you knew what true form could do for your life, you know? If you didn't have a rebellion and fault, you would have been shown the value of true form. You would have learned to love form by now. You know, and it would really help. So they're trying to get us to reconsider our rejection of form.
When you've reached a certain status, now you can transport yourself. So now status, in my mind, is equating to power.
Like I said, I mean, you're brilliant. To transport, you have to grab a hold of energy.
You're always saying, you have to challenge yourself. You have to lift yourself. And I'm going, lift myself. How do I lift myself? I lift myself by stretching my intellect. It's not by the silent meditation, oh, help me lift myself up. That just doesn't work.
Right, because technically, you're not lifting yourself up.
No.
Man cannot cause growth. You're supplying the favorable conditions to be lifted.
The status, you know, is the other word that we don't like.
Yeah, and I was just going to get to that. But just, you know, on that power personality synthesis, see, you, when you have enough synthesis between power and personality, you can lock on to the energy flows. Yeah. But you have to achieve that relationship of your personality to that power. Okay? And it's an objective fact. It's an expression of the state you are in. It's your status. Okay? You know, the problem again, why is status a word that makes us cringe? It's because it's sad to record. That almost all human thought is subjective consciousness. And so we corrupt every word. We think that status, you know, is a subjective word. Okay? And it becomes just wholly negative. No, status is an objective word. You have objective states of existence. Not only are they objective states, but they're hierarchically ordered. Okay? Yeah. Because there's a first source and center that's transcendent of everything and forces everything to fall into line underneath it. Okay? You will be ordered in a vertical hierarchy or you will not exist. Man, and you will be tested, right? But status, state, you know, think of it, you know, what is that word? It's referring to the state that you're in. What is your nature, your objective nature? It has nothing to do with what you like to imagine you are. Well, I'm very high status, you know. Those who look at you objectively, you know, just kind of, you know, isn't that precious? they you know. Can you start to, you know, have the courage to recognize you start out in lowly status, but in spite of that, you're absolutely loved. That's what you're looking for, is the absolute love, which is absolute, not relative. It's independent of status. You don't need status to be absolutely loved, because it's absolute love. It's not relative love. Don't try to acquire the love that you seek with false status. Failure to distinguish between the material and the spiritual. You know, blur those together. You get it all messed up. They mentioned specifically that we're granted clearance for Sanarrington, because of all the ones, you know, you can immediately, you know, I mean, they say, and you are even more, but it's a little, and you're going, well, what do they mean? I don't even know what they mean by that, but I know why I would be granted clearance to Sanarrington. That's pretty obvious. I know I'm an ascending son, or at least I eventually will be. I'm kind of just a face son right now, but, I know I'm going to have some connection to Sanarrington, especially when I've made it all the way to paradise. Oh, and that's right. I do have a significant relationship to Sanarrington. So it's not like all of the secrets are off limits. They can give us clues about Sanarrington, like I was pointing out. They do give you clues about the secrets of Sanarrington, because some of those things you can acquire experientially. They can't give it to you all in a nice little package with a bow tied around it, but they can sprinkle little, you know, hints, and you can experientially put them together. Yeah. So that's why that one has hints relative to the other ones don't, because you have such a definitive eventual relationship to Sanarrington.
What about the last sentence?
Let's see here. There's always going to be aspects that are completely off limits. I mean, obviously, I'm never going to know anything about the literalness of the incarnation process. But some of the basic external aspects of it, I can, you know, externalize sort of aspects of it, you know, like what aspects of the mother are related to this phenomenon and some things like that. I mean, I'm never going to know about the actual internal mechanics of it, because I'm not a creator being.
Is that because if we knew that, then we would try to do it? Somebody might try to do it themselves?
No, I mean, it's not knowable. It's unknowable. It's in the same sense as right now, if they plop you on paradise, nothing on paradise is currently knowable to you. It would be a zero experience. You have no way to, you know, get any input. You're not connected to it. And you're never going to be connected to this stuff. So if someone tries to tell you these secrets, all you'll hear is, you won't hear anything. There's no way to actually transfer those facts into your consciousness. There's no relationship. You know, you'll hear the void when they, I mean, right now the secrets are being blasted, you know, at 100 million watts, and you don't hear anything, and you never will, because you can't tune to that. Yeah, you just have no relationship to that. It's just like, you know, we can never get at the existential core of the adjuster. So we never have a relationship to Divinington. Yeah, it's just not accessible. It's like right now the whole absentite exists, but you can't engage it. You have no way to, you know, experience it. Just like when all is said and done with the finite, you will no longer have any way to experience the finite. It's not really like the whole finite domain somehow disappears. It's just that no one will be able to experience it anymore. No one will have any way to feel it anymore. There will be no, I was talking to Katie about this here just recently. You know, a way to think about that is, you know, if you think about it vertically, it's okay, here's the absentite domain up here, and here's the finite domain down here, and there's a little doorway that allows you to get into the finite and experience things down there. You'll be bigger than the door at some point. You won't be able to get back down in. And there's just no way to experience finite stuff anymore. A transcendentaler is made bigger than the door. You know, and so he can't experience the finite.
But won't we embody the finite?
Right. The finite, see, right. See, and that's a way to think about it. The finite doesn't disappear. Because if it disappeared, you'd disappear. Or at least everything except some sort of thin little white paint film on the outside of you that's absentite, you know, but you'd be hollow inside. I mean, it's not like, you know, suddenly the finite disappears and all of reality collapses or something, or you collapse as an empty shell. It's just that it's totally internalized, just like that existential core of the adjuster, and you can never directly experience it anymore. You're just built upon that foundation now. You can bear the fruits of having that as a foundation, just like you can bear the fruits of having the adjuster existential core within you, but you can't directly experience the non-experienceable existentialness of it. You can't experience that which is not experienceable. Yeah. And the existential is not experienceable. Okay? That's why it's called existential. Okay. Eventually, we might finish this section. No, that's okay. Yeah.
Eventually, you will have full access to Ascendington and relative access to the other spheres of the Father except Divinington. But even when you are granted permission to land on 5 additional secret spheres, after you have become a Finaliter, you will not be allowed to visit all sectors of such worlds, nor will you be permitted to land on the shores of Divinington, the bosom of the Father, though you shall surely stand repeatedly at the right hand of the Father. Never throughout all eternity will there arise any necessity for your presence on the world of the thought adjusters.
So you're never going to have this direct, undownstepped relationship with the infinite upholder. You're always going to be down in the womb of mother. You're never going to get up into the matrix of the infinite upholder and its relation, you know, direct relationship to the infinite capacity. You're never going to be up there. And hence, you're never going to be on to Vennington.
Does that mean that our adjusters are, because we're cleaved with our adjusters, we're...
Yeah, they can't go back there ever again. See, they look at the sacrifice that they make for your sake. They cut themselves off. Even as imprisoned as it often is. Yeah. Okay. Notice again, they're getting us to think about the bosom of the Father, the right hand of the Father, contrast out of the Bible. Okay, so just like the eternal Son, you know, as a son of the Father, you will stand, you know, right there with the eternal Son next to the Father many times. You know, so you can, you know, stand at the right hand of the Father next to the eternal Son. But you can never, you know, go beyond that right hand location. You can't actually go sort of inside to the depths of the lastly of the Father, that most transcendent and removed fact of the infinite upholder that has this little footprint of location, you know, within things of Divinity. It's just, you know, amazing little kind of chunk of the infinite level stuck down as a paradise satellite. the most outside is on the inside in this little bubble. It's kind of an interesting thought.
Divinington has landed on us.
Right, we don't have to go to Divinington. Divinington came to us, yes.
So thought adjusters and light beings.
Yeah, and, you know, some Father fragments, and they say, you know, there's some other, you know, unrevealed beings that, you know, are there too, but they have to be these beings that have this very pure, singular relationship with the purity of the Father. All right.
Yep. One of the things Chris was talking about, that they give up a lot for us, but on the other hand, isn't one of the main goals of the thought adjusters to achieve personality, and this is how they do it.
Right. See, you know, and just notice how we always want to think about what we lose or what they lose. You know, it's like, yeah, nothing of value is ever lost. Okay, no one has actually lost anything. It's only gaining. You know, you unpack the I am, you break its singular unity, and you don't lose anything. You gain everything. You know, like you've heard me say some. I mean, to turn things around to the eternity viewpoint, where you can think of non-deity as being a super additive consequence of deity. That deity is striving to transcend and acquire direct relationship to non-deity. It's like, wow, that's like totally upside down. Yeah, you know, it works both ways. You know, you start with a very matter-of-fact relationship to non-deity, you know, so for you, it's like, you know, what's the big, you know, you don't need to strive for that. You know, there's nothing there for you. You know, we're all thinking, it's like, no, that's everything. It's completely transcendent for, you know, for something that's just deity.
Well, and there's another analogy to that, too, in the traditional Christian idea of Jesus sacrificing himself for our lives, when in fact what we know from the revelation is that he was here to gain something to add to his overall bestowal plan. So it wasn't a sacrifice.
Yeah, right. It's just on and on you go. You start to just notice that, yeah, almost everything we do, we use our spiritual consciousness to understand it in the negative. Yeah, and we just have to challenge ourselves to stop doing that, to turn it around. All right. What else we have here?
These rendezvous worlds of spirit life are forbidden ground to the extent that we are asked not to negotiate entrance to those phases of these spheres which are wholly outside our realms of experience. You may become creature perfect, even as the universal Father is deity perfect, but you may not know all the experiential secrets of all other orders of universe personalities. When the Creator has an experiential personality secret with his creature, the Creator preserves that secret in eternal confidence.
A couple little things in there. Notice how they didn't capitalize deity, even as Universal Father is deity perfect. You know, you're lining up with the Father in a bottom-up deity sort of a way, not a top-down deity sort of way. So they purposely reminded you of that by not capitalizing deity. Like I've pointed out a number of times, they do that just as a little aid of understanding. And then notice how this is something we were referring to, about how nothing is automatic. See, these rendezvous worlds of the spirit life are forbidden ground to the extent that we are asked not to negotiate entrance to those phases of these spheres. Okay? I mean, you know, notice that it's not like there's just really, really sharp concertina wire, you know, that keeps you from getting in there. Okay? It's an absolute free will choice. Yeah? You could, you know, it's not like there's a wall. I mean, you could walk across that line, but you choose not to, because you know, I mean, let's take it out of this context. You know, whatever it is that you're choosing, you know, when you are perfected, you do it because you know it's the best thing for you. Hence, it's the right thing to do. You know, and of course, like we're saying in this case, you know it's completely pointless. and so you go, well, if you're not going to experience anything, why not just go there? You know, he speaks to that a little bit. But even without bringing the details, just that fact that you absolutely allow there to be this order within you. You see the structure of the universe, and you know it has an order, and you conform with that order. You know, the order is you walk on this path, not on that path. You know, et cetera. And
it's one of the reasons that law enforcement isn't such a big thing there, because we become law abiding just by our own nature.
Right, you be
it's written on our hearts.
Right, the law is written in your hearts. You stop rejecting order.
All these secrets are supposedly known to the collective body of the Trinitized secrets of supremacy. These beings are fully known only by their special world groups. They are little comprehended by other orders. After you attain paradise, you will know and ardently love the 10 secrets of supremacy who direct Ascendington. Accepting Divinington, you will also achieve a partial understanding of the secrets of supremacy on the other worlds of the Father, though not so perfectly as on Ascendington. The Trinitized secrets of supremacy, as their name might suggest, are related to the Supreme. They are likewise related to the Ultimate and to the future Supreme Ultimate. These secrets of supremacy are the secrets of the Supreme and also the secrets of the Ultimate, even the secrets of the Supreme Ultimate.
Okay, let me just point out a little bit there. So that isn't so abstract. I mean, it's actually very helpful to just work through that a little bit, so you can begin to understand kind of how things are put together a little bit better. You know, what is that paper? It's like, yes, 18, where you have the Supreme Trinity personalities. And when we finally get to 18, we'll be going through this in a little bit more detail. And if you remember, you have, by and large, they're the of days, you know, these Supreme Trinity personalities. Okay. With the one exception to that pattern of naming, where you have these Trinitized secrets of supremacy. Okay, and like right there at the beginning of that paper, they're listed in an order, which is important. It's a hierarchical order. Number one is the Trinitized secrets of supremacy, and you go down a notch, it's the Eternals of Days, and down another notch, it's the Ancients of Days. Okay? So just thinking about those three and how they fit in to what the threefold thing that they repeated twice here. Supreme, ultimate, supreme, ultimate, you know, hyphenated together. Ultimate with supreme added to it. Okay, those three deity facts, supreme, you know, the supreme, the ultimate, and the supreme ultimate, are engaging three different phases of actuality: the finite, the absonite, and the
ultimate.
No. The ultimate is engaging the absonite. What are these three phases of actuality? Finite, absonite, and
co-absolute.
Right. The supreme ultimate, you know, hyphenated together, is engaging the co-absolute domain of associativity, of association. Okay. So you know. You have the secrets of the finite and the secrets of the absonite, even the secrets of the co-absolute. It's kind of the subtext in that last line. Okay. So with that, you know, recognizing that this is what we're doing. We're looking at these three phases of actuality: finite, absonite, co-absolute, and how personality, activity, and deity is engaging those three. You have these three highest groups of beings. Okay? And this highest one, the Trinitized Secrets of Supremacy, they not only have the power of supremacy, which you might expect from their name, the Trinitized Secrets of Supremacy, like they were saying. So they have the power of supremacy, you know, lowercase s, the power of supremacy. They also have the power of ultimacy, and the power of supreme ultimacy. They have all three. You go down a notch to the Eternals of Days. Again, they're supreme Trinity personalities, so you know they have the power of supremacy. But they also have the power of ultimacy. We don't need to go into the details, but that's what, you know, kind of why they're in Havona, why they're the rulers of the worlds of Havona, the billion worlds. There's a billion Eternals of Days. So they have the power of supremacy and the power of ultimacy. You obviously see the pattern. You go down one notch, more notch, to the Ancients of Days, again, supreme Trinity personality, and that's just what they are. They just have the power of supremacy, not ultimacy and, you know, supreme ultimacy, just the power of supremacy. Remember, they're the first beings on the finite personality record. That's why they're called the Ancients of Days. And these beings that have the power of ultimacy or supreme ultimacy are not on, they're engaging, you know, they're related to the absolute or the co-absolute. They're not just a finite personality. So they're not on the finite personality record. They're eternals, for instance, of days, you know. There's no record of their beginning. Okay, so that's the deal with those top three. It's filling out the three different ways you can relate to these three. One just supreme, one serene and ultimate, one with all three. The Trinitized Secrets of Supremacy touch upon some really high stuff. The co-absolute stuff, the supreme ultimate personality activity that engages that co-absoluteness. Okay? And so to see that, you know, they're on that innermost circuit, that they're the rulers of that innermost circuit of the 10 circuits of the central universe, and they've got the fullness. Yeah, that seems very appropriate. They've got all three. They've maximized because they need to be able to handle stuff that goes all the way to the co-absolute on that central circuit. Now, just one other little thing that to throw in there and reflect on. The Trinitized Secrets of Supremacy and the Eternals of Days are not God. They're these incredibly high facts, but they're not personalized deity. They're just divinity, you know. In some cases, very high, like supreme ultimate divinity, okay, is embodied in them. Very high divinity, but they're not deity that's personalized. They're not God. The Ancients of Days are God. So when you start to study these a little more, you discover that there's this very tight correlation, a kinship between the Eternals of Days in Havona and the Ancients of Days out in super universes. And it's like, why is there such a tight kinship? I mean, if they're really, you know, we were just talking about them kind of being above each other, not really on the same level. You know, the Eternals of Days have both the power of supremacy and the power of ultimacy, and the Ancients of Days just have the power of supremacy. Yeah, but they're God. That takes it up a notch. And so it gives them this kinship, you know, where they synchronize well together. So that's the reason I bring that up is that, you know, when you start to think about the architects of the Master Universe, for instance, you know, and they're at these absonite beings, you know, there's all these different ways. See that you this is correlated together, where you can have really tight connections between deity and divinity, by boosting the divinity, you know, to kind of make up for the lack of deity, you know, as it were. And you can get them synchronized, you know, really tightly. And okay, those are the kind of things that are kind of sort of between the lines of a lot of these details that they're giving you, trying to get you to kind of appreciate this incredible dance between deity and divinity that, you know, is being played here. And so you have these 70 Trinitized Secrets of Supremacy, 10 on each of the seven worlds. And very high beings. You know, that very fact, you know, that they tell you that you will know and ardently love the 10 secrets of supremacy who direct Evinnington. Okay, now that I've kind of gone through that, that should tell you a little something about what's in store for you just, you know, in getting to be a finaliter. You actually have to develop the first threads of relationships with some pretty high facts in order to get to paradise. You don't just waltz onto paradise, you know, as a purely finite sort of a thing. You have to work your way up Havona, and as you're working your way up through Havona, you're starting sort of with just a purely finite sort of a thing like you understand right now, and you're working definitively upward. Especially once you get past the third circuit, and you found the Father, and he's kind of initiated you for the new challenge of really going beyond supremacy to a degree, at least in some, you know, internalized way, because you've got to be able to engage absolute mind on the aisle. So you got to work your way up through the absonite and the ultimate and the co-absolute to the absolute, at least in some, you know, minimal little internalized way, or, you know, you're not actually going to ever be a resident of paradise if you don't do that. And so, see, that's telling you a little something. You know that those two inner circuits are about really starting to climb up from just supremacy. Okay. And, you know, so this, and this is another, you know, it's definitely afoot. This higher stuff is going on in the central universe. You know, we know at least one definitive case right now of where it's going on with the Trinitized Secrets of Supremacy. Some co-absolute stuff is there. And you'll see when we get to the end of the paper, he refers more directly to this fact that the whole spectrum is actually in there in the central universe, because you need it. You need to leverage off that whole ladder of stuff in order to get yourself up onto paradise. You know, you got to finally kind of do a little grappling hook on some co-absolute and swing up on, you know, off of it onto the aisle. You need some little relationship to the co-absolute in order to get up to the absolute.
That's why you ardently love them.
Yeah, you know, to love them. I mean, you know, that means you have a really tight, you know, that's a purely personal fact. And the personality activity goes all the way up to the supreme ultimacy in them. So, see, that's what I'm saying. It means you can relate in a very deep way. But of course, that's kind of almost a secondary if you really think about, you know, if you actually can get onto the aisle and develop all this intimacy with what's going on there, that's the absolute aisle. That's a notch above the supreme ultimate. Okay. So, yeah, that's what I'm just trying to get you to think really, you know, literally and appreciate just what an incredible climb we're going to be talking about when we get to the next paper, going through the central universe. You know, you got to climb all the way up to sevenfold and then go way beyond the top of the sevenfold in order to get to the aisle. The sevenfold stops at the third circuit. You got some serious climbing to do. Getting a relationship to the universal Father in the sevenfold on the third circuit is just the beginning of the challenge in front of you. And even once you finally get to the aisle, you still have this incredible challenge in order to get to be a finaliter. You're still kind of climbing even on the seemingly planar surface of the aisle. You know, and there's a lot of places when they, in the paper there, they refer to that, how arduous this is. And, you know, and try get to the point where that doesn't dishearten you, you know, because, you know, when you read about the secondary supernafim and you read about the pilgrim helpers, there's something about not being daunted by that anymore. I bet you Chris can quote a couple of lines of that.
About feasting and
yes, right. You know, by the time you get there, I mean, the steeper the climb and the more, you know, remote the apex, the more you love it. It's like, oh, yes. And, you know, if I don't climb to the top of that mountain here, I haven't achieved the pinnacle of reality. Okay, so you climb to the top of the tallest mountain here. How close are you to the aisle? If you're an orange man and you pile up lots and lots of rocks to try to transcend the plane, how close are you to the aisle? Not very close. To try to, you know, get some patience and some humility and some, you know, take it slowly but surely, you know. Don't get so frenetic about climbing imaginary delusions, you know, here on earth. All right. Well, why don't we wrap it up there? Let's take a moment here to reflect on that.